Last week, we went through the text of chapter 11. The text that basically describes the sin of David and Bathsheba. We did say that there are two approaches in the Mefarshim. We use the Abarbanel as being one extreme and the Malbim the other. Maybe I shouldn't even use the word extremes. Let's just say approaches. The approach of the Abarbanel, as we said, is that what our rabbis say in the Talmud, which we will talk about in a little while, what our rabbis say in the Talmud, to minimize the sin of David, is he considers it sermonics, he considers it drash, but not pshat. And therefore, the Abarbanel is ready and willing to live with the idea that he sinned greatly, and he did tshuva greatly, and therefore he emerges from the fall. He fell. He fell, but he rose. The Malbim takes the approach that we have no choice but, as we read the chapter, to see that our rabbis were right. And we're going to go through the chapter again and point out what it was that the Abarbanel said, that the Malbim said. In other words, it seems clear we're not talking about a woman who is a truly a married woman. Legally, she's not a married woman. She's not even Nida. It's not what it seems at first glance. The only thing that we have to explain in order to understand the Abarbanel is really, I'm basing what I'm going to say now on an essay that was written by Rav Dessler, and it's something that I, an approach basically that I received from my Rabbeim in my study of Tanakh. And if there is a place in Tanakh where we have to understand, where we have to have an approach, we have to know how to read the words of Tanakh. In a few minutes, give me a few minutes, and you'll understand what I'm getting to. Language, in order to be understood, I have to have a frame of reference. The same word or the same phrase doesn't mean the same thing to different people in different times or in different places. The first example that that Rav Dessler gives, and we're going to give other examples. Geneva, theft. Gemara tells us a story of Rav Safra. Rav Safra was in the middle of davening, and somebody comes and wants to buy something from him. He's in the middle of davening, he's in the middle of Kriyat Shema. He can't respond. The fellow who's speaking to him doesn't know that he's in the middle of Kriyat Shema. I don't know, Rav Safra has an animal up for sale, his horse is up for sale. Fellow says, I'll give you 100 zuz. No response out of Rav Safra. So he says, 150 zuz. Still no response out of Rav Safra. Man goes up to 200 zuz. Finally, Rav Safra finishes davening, and he turns around to him, and he tells him, I'll give you the horse for 100 zuz. That was the first price that he had mentioned. Now the man had gone up already to 200. So Rav Safra tells him, when you offered me 100 zuz for the horse, in my mind, I thought to myself, I'm ready to sell for 100 zuz. And therefore he said, on a pasuk in Tehillim, Dover emet bilvavo, man has to speak truth in his heart. As far as Rav Safra is concerned, if he would have taken 101 zuz for that horse, Rav Safra would have considered it theft. Can you imagine anybody else considering that theft? But in the frame of reference of Rav Safra, in the language that he spoke, which of course is the sum total of his piety, his sanctity, his study of Torah, the community in which he lives, everything that makes up Rav Safra is such that as far as he's concerned, if in his mind he had already agreed to a price of 100 zuz, that's all he will take. A penny more is Geneva. The Tosefta says that if somebody quotes something and does not attribute the source from which he took the quote, or somebody says something and really it was said by somebody else, they consider that Geneva. That's theft. I don't know. Well, I don't know. Plagiary would most probably be if one publishes or prints. And I have a feeling that even plagiary is a nice way of saying Geneva. Yeah, but there's different kinds of Geneva. You know, there's a Geneva, and then there's one, huh? All right, okay, wait. We're coming to that. So first, by the way, quoting something and not attributing the quote is Genevat Dat. Genevat Dat is, by the way, a term that has no parallel and no equal in any other language. Genevat Dat, I stole your mind. You know what I mean? I stole your mind. I left you with a false impression. I mean, what did I take from you? Did I take anything? Do you have any less mind now than you had before? What did I take from you? Didn't take anything from you. It's Genevat Dat. That's also Geneva. In Halacha, there is even the concept of Gezel Shina. If I interrupt somebody's sleep, I have stolen something. What about a ganef, a mafioner? By him, even Geneva isn't Geneva, unless you steal from him. So here we have the same word, Geneva, but it has completely different meanings, and it depends on your frame of reference. Who is it that's saying it? Where does he live? What's his background? In what century is he living? For many people, there are all sorts of little things that would be Geneva, according to Halacha, but the society in which we live, it's not such Geneva. You know, I don't know whether it's taking home paper clips or sitting on the phone and calling a friend during working hours. I mean, there are all sorts of things that, from the point of view of Torah morality, is Geneva. Nah, Siti, I mean, look, what did I do? Gone is begone. The term Geneva, of course, even in our time, means all sorts of different things to different people. For example, a piece of land that was purchased legally and permission has been given and granted to build on that piece of land. So I think most people would say that this is fine, this is good. Then you'll get Ran Koren or Shulamit Aloni, and they will say, for Jews to build in Eretz Yisrael on land that they have passed all of the bureaucratic hurdles, which in and of itself is already a tremendous accomplishment, they will say that this is Geneva. Jews having Marat HaMachpelah and Kever Rachel, this is Geneva or Kibush or conquest. Right? Of course, in the terms, if we have to use the terms of the people, for example, whom Shulamit Aloni comes to protect, they will turn around at some point and they'll say to Shulamit Aloni, the home in which you live is Geneva. It's all yours. You got it. So just giving you an example, the term Geneva depends on time, place, location, philosophy of life, background. What does a person stand for? What are the what is one's level of morality or ethics? Truth, God. There are most probably more definitions to the word truth. Everybody claims to be the one that possesses truth. Everybody has truth. Everybody's truth is different. All you have to do is just listen to Peres and Gavin, and that's, of course, one truth. A Time magazine poll is a completely different truth. I mean, everybody is selling the truth, but everybody has a different truth. I mean, we can go on for hours about the approaches or what's an understanding of the word truth. In so many ways, terms that were once understood in one way have changed dramatically with the passage of time. For example, there are community standards. Community standards. There are things that are acceptable by a community at a certain period of time, and then they are unacceptable in other times. I mean, as Chatoya and Imasta, young and saying, little boy in Williamsburg, we went to the movies on Friday. What did you do on a long Friday afternoon? You went to the movies. And if you went to one of the real cheap places, you were able to see three movies in one Friday afternoon and still make it home in time to get ready for Shabbos. You were not able, you didn't see what is standard fare in films today. I mean, it's completely different. Community standards have changed so differently. The media of a film speaks in a completely different language. The language that is used, what would have been absolutely unacceptable and shocking a generation ago is no longer shocking today. I don't know, when I first heard the term word processor, my only experience with the word processor was a food processor. What does a word processor do? I'm only now very, very, in a very small way, beginning to come into a world that I have had. I'm sorry, never learn it. I'm trying to learn word processing. So I got a printer. So I start reading the instructions. First of all, you need a dictionary to understand the instructions. There's a whole chapter in the book about media. When I use the word media, if you don't know anything about computers, what's media? What's media? Media is radio, TV. Communication, newspapers. No, so I begin to find out that you have to choose your media very carefully. Media then meaning what kind of paper, what size of paper. Is it an envelope that you're using, or is it small sheet of paper? There's different media that's going until I learned media. I mean, so that kept me already. I've been stuck for a month on one chapter in the book. Why don't I take a course? You're right. I probably will do it, but I don't have time. I'm forever getting into trouble, and a guy who's getting into trouble doesn't have time. After the government falls, I'll take a basic course in computers. Listen, we know it, of course, in terms of the fact that every discipline has its own language. There are words and terms that are understood in the field of psychology that are not understood to others. You can't move in to a text in psychology, or in sociology, or in education, without living within that milieu. Then you begin to learn the unique language. Went to school for education. I learned all sorts of terminology. Everything from homogeneous to heterogeneous to felt needs. I thought all needs were needs, but no, there are felt needs, there are not felt needs, gifted, not gifted. There's a lot of terminology. That's simple terminology. I don't understand. I can open up a book of psychology, and I'm sure that there will be many terms that I simply won't understand. You don't understand them until you are living the field. In other words, so that in addition to the fact that we say language, words, terminology will be understood by different people by virtue of their own personal background or their own level of morality, as we use the word geneva, different people, different meaning, and in different disciplines, even to the same people, different disciplines have different terminology, and it's understood only to the person who has become fully immersed within that discipline. The world of philosophy has its own terminology. The world of theology has its own terminology. The world of technology, everything has its own terminology, understood only to those who are part of that world. Democracy. democracy is a word that has suffered abuse. I mean, there isn't only alimut, violence in the family, there is violence that can be done to language. And one of the words that has suffered a great deal from democracy, from violence, is the word term democracy. You think communist Russia didn't see itself as a democracy? The democratic republics all over the world that are absolute totalitarian dictatorships call themselves democracy. And right over here in our country, everything is... everybody talks about demokratia. Everybody talks about demokratia. So therefore, a minority government also considers itself a government that can rule and govern and take far-reaching steps in the name of demokratia, because they have been democratically elected. And of course, the two most popular people in the country, Gonen Segev and Alex Goldfarb, are of course, this is democracy at its very best and its most beautiful. Two people that simply run off with votes that didn't belong to them. They're not speaking for the people who voted for them, and they are part of a democratia. I mean, of course, my best friends, Shas. Shas, that its whole in the campaign, their sisma, their slogan was Rak im HaLikud, only with the Likud, before the votes are counted, had already made a deal with Avodah. That's also democracy. Or a democratically elected government of the state of Israel that makes a deal in advance of the election with the enemies of Israel, the PLO, that they should help them get elected. That's also democracy. Everything is democratic. And then, of course, there's real democracy. There's Jeffersonian democracy. So then somebody will tell me, Jefferson owned a lot of slaves, so what kind of democracy was that? Okay. Everybody has different terms. Violence. I'm a very soft-spoken, kind individual who wouldn't hurt a fly. So over the past weekend, number one, I was referred to as terrorist. Understand? Terrorist. This was at a convention of rabbis in the Yam HaMelech, because I wanted to the rabbis to approve resolutions calling for no removal of Tzahal from the major areas, the absolute unity of Yerushalayim under Israeli sovereignty, etc., etc., you know, things like that. So I was called a terrorist.
The rabbi?
No, one fellow. No, the rabbis all agreed. They ended up agreeing with me. Don't get me wrong. No. So somebody called me a terrorist. Or another fellow calls me Amerikai Mufra. How do you translate Mufra? Mufra. I'm trying to find the right word for Mufra. No, I'm a sugar now. Unbalanced, yes, unbalanced, that's right. Or someone else said, but don't get me wrong, like, I'm not telling you that someone, I think it was all two people that said all the things about me. Another 198 rabbis agreed with me. Okay, so I'm a good guy. Yeah. Yeah, and because I disagreed with him. And then another one said that my sermons are not fought down. They drip with blood. All right. So you see, then again, it depends whose blood. It depends who's speaking. It depends who's speaking up.
That's great.
It's worse than that. But all right. I feel personally that this is a badge of honor. Depends.
Absolutely.
Because you see, it depends who calls you the name. Right? So what the point that I want to make is an understanding of language depends on who, in what context, in what century, in what geographic location, in what field of human endeavor. Is it psychology? Is it medicine? I don't know, for the average person, an episode, what's an episode? An episode for the average person is another half an hour of some soap opera drama. That's an episode. Of course, when a cardiologist speaks about an episode, He's talking about a heart attack, right? A completely different thing. It could be somebody's soap operas give people heart attacks. But it's different terminology, different words, different context. There was a classic example. A few days, Sunday, there was a big fight in the Memshala, the Sunday, the cabinet meeting. So Ogan Amir says to Peres, "Lama tatsaway? What are you yelling?" So Peres says, "Ani lo tatsaway. Ani mitaber b'kol ra. I'm not yelling. I'm just speaking in a loud voice." You know, it means something else. Terminology is relative. It's relative to so many different things. Which means the following. The real point that I want to make is, one can understand the terminology of Tanakh only by being immersed not only in the study of Tanakh, but by being immersed in what are the Torah's standards, the Torah's standards of Kedusha, the Tahara, sanctity and holiness. You can only understand the terminology of Tanakh within the world of Tanakh. And the world of Tanakh is a world of Torah and mitzvahs, divine presence. I'll give you the example. And this is something that we said all the way back at the very beginning of this overview of Tanakh. I mean, I had thought once that in 1 year I was going to give you an overview of Tanakh. We are in our third or fourth year. In Sefer Yoshua, chapter 7, I believe, in Sefer Yoshua, what happens is that after the great battle of Jericho, the walls of Jericho come tumbling down, the second battle, Yoshua sends 3,000 men to capture the city of Ai. And lo and behold, tragedy. The Jewish forces are forced to flee and retreat from the city of Ai. And Yehoshua becomes very upset. What's going to happen now? Up until now, we were invincible. The whole world knew about the walls of Jericho coming tumbling down. Now, they're going to surround us and destroy us. And Yehoshua even goes so far as to say, "God, why did you bring us across the Jordan? Why did we come here? To fall before our enemies?" We're talking about a moment of great tragedy. And in chapter 7, it says the following, "Vayomer Hashem el Yoshua," God said to Yoshua, "Come lach, get up. Lamazat hanofel al panecha." Why are you falling on your face? Listen to the pasuk. One of the most unusual pasukim in Tanakh. God says to Yoshua, "Chata Yisrael, Israel has sinned. Gam avru et briti, they have broken my covenant. Asher tziviti otam, that I commanded them. V'gam lokhu min hacherem, they took from Yericho that which they were prohibited from taking. V'gam gonvu, they stole. V'gam kichashu, they lied. V'gam somu b'chlehem, and they placed from the spoil of Yericho into their own personal kit bags." Do you hear? This is a statement of God. And this statement of God is an indictment of all of Israel. Israel has sinned. They've stolen. They lied. They've been deceitful. And then God says, "Listen, you want to see that it's true? Bring all of Israel before the ark, and the ark is going to show you precisely what happened." Out of 3 million people, the ark finds one person who sinned. One person who sinned. Ochan ben Zavdi, one person had taken from the spoil of Yericho. One single solitary person. Would it ever have occurred to any of us to say, "Chata Yisrael, Israel sinned, stole, lied"? An indictment of an entire people. By whom? By no less than the Rabbeinu Shlomo himself. How are we to understand that puzzle? How are we supposed to understand that puzzle? We can only understand it within the context of what it is that God expects of the Jewish people. We can only understand it in terms of how God sees the relationship between the conduct of one Jew and every other Jew. It can only be understood when we realize that, as far as God is concerned, what's going to happen or what's supposed to happen over here is the creation of a perfect people where each one feels a sense of identity with the people, and therefore he won't do anything wrong in order not to lower the level of sanctity and holiness of an entire people. When you are able to put yourself into the mindset of God, then you can understand the pasuk, Chata Yisrael, all of Israel has sinned. All of Israel has sinned. I'll give you another example. We're going to have it soon. It's coming up in Parshat Ki Tisa. The Egel, Moshe Rabbeinu is up at the top of the mountain, and God tells him, Lech Reiv, go down. Ki Shichet Amcha. Your people, Shichet. Well, how would you do? Shichet.
Destroyed the brain?
Destroyed? No, more than that, they have become mushatim. Corrupted. Your people are corrupted. What do you mean? Your people are corrupted. Out of 3 million people, the sum total of those who worship the Egel were 3,000. And according to most of them, the Farshim, the 3,000 who served the Egel did not serve the Egel as a substitute for God. It was a form of worshiping God. They wanted a stand-in for God, something to symbolize God. So therefore, we're not even talking about anybody who was corrupted. Yet God says to Moshe at the top of the mountain, Lech Reiv, go down, ki shichet amcha, your people has become corrupted. We can only understand that pasuk and that terminology within the context of what it is that God expects of the Jewish people. Especially a Jewish people, only a few weeks after Maimon Har Sinai revelation at Mount Sinai, we expect something different from them. Could anybody use that kind of terminology today about any group of people because one or two have sinned? What would they say about us today? I don't know. If there's one Russian who stole, the Russians are a bunch of mafia and animals. The Svardim we know. The Svardim. What are you talking about? It would be totally unacceptable. Totally unacceptable. But the Rabbeinu Shlomo, knowing what it is that he expects of the Jewish people, and the level at which they should be, different terminology is used. Which means the terminology of Torah can only be understood within the context of a Torah system and a Torah society. If you are going to take a pasuk out of its natural habitat and its natural context, and it's going to be quoted, for example, by an ignorant foreign minister in the Knesset, it's not going to be the same pasuk because the man doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the context of Torah. He doesn't understand the requirements of Torah. He doesn't understand the language of Tanakh. It is a very, very special discipline. And the only one who can understand it is the one who swims in the sea of Tanakh. And the Jewish people have to realize that every Jew is responsible for every fellow Jew. And therefore...
They didn't know this person's hook. I mean, why should they know?
So therefore, if Dessler says that if the spiritual level of all of Israel would have been on par, that one fellow wouldn't have gone, he wouldn't have stolen. He wouldn't have stolen. He wouldn't have. Don't we act in ways depending on where one lives and what is expected of us? If the expectations of society are such, then we are social people. We're social. I was going to say social animals. We are social people. We are going to conduct ourselves in different communities, in different places, in different times, as the standard that is set by that community. But listen, even if you're going to go through the various communities of Yerushalayim, I challenge somebody to live in Me'er Sharim and conduct themselves the way they would in Ramot or even in Har Nof. Sakon is the fascist. There are different standards. It means, therefore, that society impacts greatly on the individual. The Rebbeinu Shlomo is telling the Jewish people that if they would have been on the level that they should have been, an Ochan wouldn't have dared do it. Wouldn't have dared do it. How do we feel about a person who betrays his people? Betrayed! but maybe there's something wrong with a society in there's something on some level wrong with a society in which one member of the society can go ahead and betray the rest. There's something lacking in that society. That's the way Torah would look at it. That this is an extremely stringent requirement, there's no question about it. We see that throughout all of Tanakh. It's the recurrent theme of all of Tanakh. Yes?
There's never been a perfect Jewish society. From the beginning, there's never been a
100%
perfection.
So therefore, God expects it. Because it never was, does that mean that we don't strive for it? On the contrary, here was the first breach. By Achan, it was the first breach. He just came into Eretz Yisrael. All of Israel took an oath not to take from the spoil. He spoils it for everybody. And it's also true that it's because there must be something. You know what's fascinating? I'll admit, we're all having difficulty understanding it. Do you know why we're all having difficulty understanding it? And I include myself in that. Because we cannot fully appreciate what it is that God really wants of us. The Jews in the time of Yahushua did understand. They understood it very well. There was nobody who complained that this is unjust. This was God himself who had decided and chosen such. We, 3,500 years later, have difficulty. We have difficulty understanding the requirements of Torah altogether. To what extent can we really say, even those of us who are Shomrei Torah and Mitzvahs, do we really fully appreciate the level of sanctity and the degree of purity to which Torah wants us to aspire and to reach? We don't, because we're out of that context. It's not the same Eretz Yisrael, it's not the same people. Do you know when we would have been able to understand it? If we would have been part of the generation that had gone 40 years through the desert, the ones who ate man every day, had water out of a rock, those for whom the Jordan split and we crossed the Jordan, those of us who marched around, understand, we made a demonstration, the first big demonstrators, they marched around Jericho 7 days in a row, and on the seventh day they marched around seven times, and then they blew shofar, and lo and behold, you know what happens when they blow shofar? The walls of Jericho come tumbling down. A great deal more would be required of us, and not only that, we would require a great deal more of ourselves. So what I'm saying is, Tanakh can only be understood within its natural habitat. You cannot pluck out a pasuk 3,500 years later by a person or people who have absolutely no conception of what Torah is, and yet think that they understand it. I have on a number of occasions, it's been a long time already, haven't done it in a long time, but on a number of occasions, when we learned Shoftim, I think it was the introduction to Shoftim, and it all came from that chapter in Yehoshua. It's the Vilna Gaon who says that God looks at the sins of the Jewish people like looking through a zechuchit magdelet, a magnifying glass. Magnifies the sins of Israel because the requirements, he requires a great deal from them. He wants them to be a very special people. Therefore, when you read through a Sefer Shoftim, or we're going to see a pasuk at the end of this chapter, what does it say about David? Vayas Hora, chapter 11. Everything is chapter 11. Vayas Hora. He did that which was bad in the eyes of God. I think I had sort of alluded to it last week. Vayas Hora. He did that which was that which David had done was bad in the eyes of God. What do you mean in the eyes of God? In the eyes of man it was also bad. It wasn't bad in the eyes of I don't even want to mention his name anymore. But throughout all of history, but there weren't others who saw that this is bad. Why does it say that what he did was bad in the eyes of God? And in the eyes of man, living with an Eshet Ish is good. They're sending a husband off to be killed at the front lines, that's good. How are we supposed to understand the pasuk? That what David did was bad in the eyes of God. Because if we are truly to understand what it was that David did, then you would see that in the eyes of man, it wasn't so terrible. In whose eyes was it bad? It was bad in the eyes of God because God knew what David can be. And that David should never have fallen into this mistake. It's a mistake. You know, that pasuk is, as far as I'm concerned, that last pasuk in the chapter is really the pasuk that is the commentary on the entire chapter. how can you say about a man, a king of Israel, who has committed adultery, lived with another man's wife, and sends the man off to be killed, what he did? The thing he did was bad in the eyes of God. What do you mean bad in the eyes of God? Was a horror. He's a criminal. He should be brought up before the Sanhedrin. That pasuk is the commentary on the whole chapter. If you think that this was ra, bad in the eyes of man, you better go and read the whole chapter over again. And not only, and reading the whole chapter over again is not going to help you. You know what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to start learning Torah all over again from the very beginning. You're going to have to put yourself within the emotional and religious context of Torah. You're going to have to know who a David HaMelech is. And only then would you be able to understand what's being said of him. One cannot take what's true about Tanakh, for that matter, is true about any discipline. You can't take a pasuk or a sentence out of any other discipline and expect it to be understood by the uninitiated. Go take a sentence out of Shakespeare and to really try to understand it without the entire context, without living in the Shakespearean world. Don't understand it. You won't understand it. Why do you think there are Shakespearean scholars, people have to study Shakespeare, Yom Valila, a whole lifetime, in order to truly plumb the depths of Shakespeare? Because there's a whole context. You have to understand his language, you have to understand the background, the thought processes of a Shakespeare, how he uses language, what words mean in Shakespeare. But when it comes to Tanakh, everybody thinks that there are Groyser Balabus, just like the profession in which I'm in. Not everybody thinks he's a heart surgeon, but everybody thinks he's a rabbi. Jeder Reine kennt Pasken in Ashala. Everybody knows in shul what's supposed to be done now, what's supposed to be done. I don't know what they need the rabbi there for, except to torture him, to kick him around. I understood Nixon when he said, well, you're not going to have me to push around anymore. And he stayed around for another 20 years to be pushed around. So I say that Torah is a discipline. It's most probably the most demanding discipline of all. The study of Tanakh is not simple. That we've already done for years now. We've shown the nuances of words, the position of a word. Everything has a tremendous amount of meaning, and therefore Torah can be understood only from within, not from without. I'll give you a pasuk in Torah, Parshas Chukas. Remember the whole story? Moshe hits the rock. Doesn't give out water. He hits it again. Finally, it starts trickling water. And God says, because of this, Yan lohe emantem bi, because you didn't believe me, lahagdisheni, to sanctify me, in the eyes of the people, you will not go into Eretz Yisrael. Yan lohe emantem bi, if we would use it, if we would try to translate it in our own terminology, you don't believe in me. Let's be vulgar for a minute. You're a kofer. You're an apikotis, you're a ming, you're a heretic, you're a blasphemer. How does the Rebbeinu use such terminology about Moshe Rabbeinu? Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't believe in it? What are you talking about? Vayamin v'ashemu v'moshe avdo. What do you think? Yom lo hemantem bi. And the fact is that the Mepharshim have such a difficulty finding out what was the sin of. They can't even figure out. They can't even agree what was Moshe Rabbeinu's sin. The word has to be understood on the level of who Moshe is. For Moshe, say it in the Rambam. The Rambam says, Bala Klal Kas. He came to the point of nearly getting angry. For Moshe Rabbeinu to get angry, this is something that is a demonstration of a lack of perfect, absolute faith. The kind of faith, by the way, that is expected only of Moshe and nobody else. The word, He'emantem, can only be understood within that context. Any other attempt to understand it is going to fail. I started saying that we had talked in the past in all of those psukim in Sefer Shoftim Vayasu harabi enyash, and the Jewish people did that which was evil in the eyes of God, and they bowed down to Baal and Ashtaroth, and they worshipped idols, and either stories time and time again of the Jewish people, you get the impression, you get the feeling as though the Jewish people are a bunch of God-forsaken idolaters. It's not so. It's not true. We proved that the number of people amongst the Jewish people who served idols was minute. It was small, but even that should not have happened by a Jewish people that were living in Eretz Yisrael, where they were the beneficiaries of the divine presence every day. So that words, sentences, phrases can only be understood within the system. Therefore, I can very well, I very well understand why the rabbis come along and say, Kol ha'omer, David, chota, whoever said that David sinned, eino, whoever says that David sinned, eino elatoa, is making a mistake. You don't know the meaning of the word sin, and you don't know what it was that David did here. What I'm saying, therefore, is that we have to approach the whole story of David and Bathsheba and realize that we are not fully capable of comprehending the terminology of Tanakh, because we are not living or experiencing the world of Tanakh. Certainly somebody whose connection to Tanakh and to Torah and Yiddishkeit is very, very weak has no way whatsoever of appreciating it. And despite that, I've been honest enough, of course, to tell you that yes, on the one hand, you have the Abarbanel who's ready to accept it kipshuto. It's the simple meaning of the words. But then again, remember, how many times does Rashi say in Chumash that a term is used, for example, when it talks about, how many times does it talk about the finger of God, the hand of God, the eyes of God? What does that terminology mean? Does God have hands? Does God have eyes? Of course he doesn't. And we have a whole Torah that talks about God's eyes and God's hands. Why? So Rashi says very often that Torah speaks in language l'saber et ha'ozen, that the ear can hear. In other words, it means that the human mind should be able to comprehend. We are so limited. We can only appreciate and understand things in physical terms. We're incapable of speaking. We don't even have the words with which to describe an invisible God. We have no choice but to talk about the finger of God, or the hand of God, or the might of God, or the anger of God. In some of the descriptions of God's anger, it would seem as though he's frothing at the mouth, but he has no mouth. So terminology is used only in order to bring great things down to a level where we should be able to appreciate it. What happens if I would say, as a result of all of those psukim, that yes, God has hands and eyes and a nose from which he gets angry and his anger burns in him? That's tefillah. If I would take those words in Torah at face value, that's absolute blasphemy. Which means, therefore, same thing is true when we talk about the story of David. And here, of course, the Malbim comes in. If there's a real sin of Eshet Ish over here, how does he remain married to her? Not only how does he remain married to her, the child that is born is the one who's blessed by God to be the next king. The man is living in sin with her. So obviously, we have to first approach every pasuk in Tanakh, and certainly these chapters, we have to approach them b'dechilu u'rechilu, with fear and trembling, that we don't make a terrible mistake. We also have to approach it with the knowledge that this is represents a very, very special system with its own language, its own terminology, and can only be understood within that context, a context that even we, even the Jews, the Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, cannot fully comprehend that context. Okay. Two Mamarei Chazal. Two statements of our rabbis. I mean, they also had different approaches to the story of David and Bathsheba. One Gemara is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and the other is going to be a Gemara in Masechta Shabbos. The Gemara says the following: Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, La'olam ayavei Adam atzma lideni sayon. Person should never bring himself to a position where he's going to be tested. Now, a person should not permit himself to be in such situations where he's going to be tested. Nobody can be absolutely certain of themselves how they're going to react under different circumstances. In other words, I don't know, a person who's very, very hungry should not walk into a McDonald's, a place of McDonald's. Well, no, I can give you other examples, but somebody may listen to this tape. I'm not going to give you other examples. That's the nicest one I can think of right now. All right. Or if one doesn't want to get angry, if you want to work on your temper, don't go into the Knesset. Don't read newspapers. Don't listen to the news. Don't watch TV. Right? because you know that you're going to read a newspaper, you're going to go into the Knesset, you're just going to explode. I control myself. I want you to know, I'm not a terrorist. I'm not a mufra. Last night, Rabin spoke at the Moraya, right up here at the corner, for the mission of the rabbis who came for Israel bonds. And I'd met a number of my rabbi friends over here, and one of them comes over and he says, "Oh, I called. I have a ticket for the dinner. Come, be my guest. Come into the dinner." And I thought to myself, I'm going to be able to sit there and listen to Rabin speak without getting up and exploding in a paroxysm of justifiable anger? Impossible. I won't be able to do it. And then most of these conservative and reform and sort of Orthodox rabbis are going to take a look at me and they're going to say, because they don't understand the context in which we're living. I spoke to them, they don't understand, they don't feel our pain and our fears and our suffering day in and day out. They come flying in and they get flying back and they're out of it. They're just not living it. And by the way, that incidentally is a classic example. If we want to realize how it is impossible for somebody who doesn't live in the world of Tanakh to truly understand Tanakh, just as with all of the media, the real meaning, or the first meaning of media, with all the media that's available, they can know everything that's going on here. But if you're not living here, you're not living here, and if it's not the year or year and a half in which one has been at more laborious than any other year in their life, you don't feel it.
What about all the rabbis who are living here? Where are they?
We've raised their consciousness. You're right. They're all going to start becoming terrorists. Watch, you'll see. You'll see, it's happening. But that's not... I never talk politics. I think I've said that every year for the last year and a half. What I'm saying is that one has to live within a certain atmosphere in order to fully understand and appreciate it. What I was talking about is, the point that I really wanted to make is, to explain this Gemara, I'm trying to learn a Gemara over. A person should never bring himself to a point where he's going to be tested. Believe me, I told my rabbi friend, thank you, no thank you, I'm not going to go into that dinner, because I knew that if I would go into that dinner, either they would hustle me out, I'd be in jail by now and wouldn't be in class this morning. I knew I couldn't control myself, so I didn't go in. Says the Gemara, Omar Rav, Yehuda Omar Rav, Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav, La'olam ayyavi arts, odam atzma lideni sayon. A person should never bring himself to a point where he is going to be tested. Shehadei David melech Yisrael, hevi atzmo lideni sayon. David, king of Israel, brought himself to a point where he was tested, the nichshal, and he failed. What was the? No. The Gemara is going to explain. No. Watch. Amal Afanav, he said before God. He said, "Lefnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Ribbono Shel Olam, mitnei ma omrim Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, veElokei Yaakov, veEin omrim Elokei David." What did they say? The Torah talks about Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Why not Elokei David? I mean, obviously, he's not wrong. He sees himself as God had said earlier. There was a pasuk earlier that I'm going to give you a name, Kishem HaGedolim Hashem Baruch, like the great ones. Who are the great ones? The patriarchs, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. So he asks, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, why don't they say Elokei David? Amar, so God said to him, Heim Minsu, they were tested, and you weren't tested. Vatlo Minsu, you weren't tested by me. So Amar Lefana, so David said, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, B'chaneini V'naseini, Rabbeinu Shel Olam, ready. Test me. Shenama, a pasuk in Tilim, where David HaMelech says, B'chaneini Hashem V'naseini, test me. Amar, God said, I'm going to test you, but I'm going to give you a head start. I'm going to do something for you. Dilidid who? To Avram, Yitzhak of Yaakov, when they were tested, they didn't know in advance what was going to be a test. They didn't know what the test was going to be about. I didn't tell them anything. Eloan, but with regard to you, I'm going to tell you what the test is going to be. It's going to be bedvar erva. It's going to have something to do with erva, with an illicit relationship. And the Gemara says, Nitnase, he was tested, and he failed. The nifshal, tested and failed. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I have a question on testing. How likely is it tested and will not be from the time of his birth, and the man did not fail.
I mean,
that's a test in Emunah that we learn from.
Everybody's life is a constant test. David, what happened over here is he had gone one slight step beyond propriety in terms of his, in a sense, the pride that he felt about himself, that he would never fail a test. It was precisely that little gaiva, I don't even want to use the word gaiva, I can't even use, but that's what the Mefarshim is. Like, there was something about it, it was, you know, because I can't use the word gaiva or arrogance or conceit, because these are words also that can be understood in one context, but they're not words that can be used in the context of David HaMelech.
The fact that he asked that he should be placed among Avram, Yitzhak and Yaakov was in itself.
That was it, except that he had reason to say it, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him earlier, and we learned the pasuk, that you will be Kishem HaGdolim Asher
Ba'aretz. But a person who has humility doesn't place themselves in the place where they're supposed to be. They usually set themselves in the place.
So that's why the Gemara says that a person should never bring himself, don't we say it in davening in the morning, Ba'al Tivienu, the Benishon, don't bring us Lidei Nisayon. What really happens over here is, while at the same time this Maimon Chazal is really telling us that by right David is up there with Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, but what it's also doing is it's making the error of Batsheva even worse, because he should have known in advance that he was going to be tested with Batsheva, or he was going to be tested in a matter of erva. He asked for it. Yeah, when I say that he made an error, nikshal, I'm not saying that he was nikshal with Eshet Ish. Chas v'shalom, nikshal, he was nikshal, that he failed the test. One thing is certain, there was some impropriety in what he did. Nobody is whitewashing him completely. The question is, no, even with Batsheva. Nobody's saying that this was beautiful, great. Oh, Yishama Bada, nobody's saying that. But there's a big difference between saying it was an impropriety or saying that it was a chet of Eishes Eish. I mean, all the difference in the world. The second Gemara, and with that we'll close, the second Gemara is, of course, the position that is taken by the Malbim and most of the Mefarshim. I had quoted most of the Gemara to you, but or part of the Gemara. The other is the Gemara in Shabbos, Amar Rav Shmuel Banach, Banachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Rav Shmuel Banachmeni said in the name of Rabbi Yonatan, Kol Ha'omer David Chata, Eino Elatoa. Whoever says David sinned, Eino Elatoa is making a mistake. Making a mistake, and I say that he's making a mistake because he simply doesn't understand the terminology and the context of Tanakh. Just doesn't understand. Doesn't realize. Shenema, how do we know that he's making a mistake if you think that David sinned? Because it says later, we're going to come in chapter 18, it says, Vayihi David Lechol Drochav Maskil. David, in all of his ways, succeeded by Shem Imo, and God is with him. Says the Gemara, Is it possible to say that a man sinned so, and the divine presence is with him? So the Gemara asks, what am I going to do with the pasuk that we're going to learn in the next chapter, where the Navi says to Madua Bozita, why did you shame Edvar Hashem la'asot hara, to do this evil? Says the Gemara, you know what la'asot hara means? Shebikesh la'asot v'lo asa. The thought crossed his mind to do. La'asot means to do. La'asot does not necessarily mean did. He wanted to do, but he never really did it. What he's really being judged for is maybe a fleeting thought, a second of intent. La'asot means something that he wanted to do, but not something that he indeed did. The Gemara goes on to say, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi said about David, Rabbi Yomei Meshunor Ra'azu Mikol Ra'az Shabbat Torah. The evil of David is different than the evil of or Ra'a, something bad done in all of the rest of Tanakh. Shekol Ra'ol Shabbat Torah, every time somebody did something bad in Torah, it says, Vaya'as, and he did. The conctive La'asot, and here it says the word La'asot, it's different. Rebbe zeroed in on the one word that is used with regard to David, different than all others. And therefore, la'asot, he also says that it means shebikesh la'asot, he wanted to do, v'lo asa, but he didn't really. Umashenema, what are we going to do with the pasuk, where the pasuk accuses him, et Uriah hachiti hikita bacherev, Uriah the chiti, you smote by the sword? Says the Gemara, the sin of David over there was shehoyah l'chol adono b'sanhedrin, you should have judged him by the Sanhedrin, v'lo danta. In other words, that Uriah was chayiv misa, that he deserved death penalty, yes, but it should have been carried out by the Sanhedrin and not in the way you did. That ishta l'kachta l'chol isha, and his wife you took unto, you as a wife, a posit that we're going to come to later, says the Gemara, l'kachta likuchin yesh l'chapa, you have the right to take her. In other words, legally, ki yikach ish isha, the word yikach, always when used with regard to ish v'isha, represents, yes, likuchin yesh l'chapa, you do have the right to take her. Dom Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni, Am Rav Yonatan, because Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni said in the name of Rav Yonatan, and this is the part of the Chazal that we said already a number of times, Kol hayotze l'milchemet beit David, kotev get kritut leishto. Anybody who went out to war in the days of David, divorced his wife before he went out to war. And therefore, later on, when David is going to be accused, Oto, Uriah achiti harakta, you killed Becherev b'nei Amon with the sword of the people of Amon, says the Gemara, Ma cheret b'nei Amon ia panena shalav, just like you are not punished for the sword of b'nei Amon, af Uriah hachiti ia panena shalav, you're not going to be punished for what happened to Uriah hachiti. In other words, you caused his death. Death was caused through what? Through the sword of b'nei Amon. Is a Jew responsible for what b'nei Amon did? No. Why are you not going to be held responsible for this? My time, the Gemara asks. What's the reason? Because modid the malchut hava. Uriah Hachiti was a Morid the Malchut. He rebelled against kingdom. The Ka'amale, because he said to David, and that's in this chapter, Adoni Yoav, the Avde Adoni al Pnei Hasad Echonim. He refers to Yoav in the presence of David as Adoni, my master, Yoav. This is an act of rebelliousness. So that means, can't read the Psukim simply. We're not talking about Eshet Ish. We're not talking about somebody who is not guilty of sin, who an innocent person who's being brought down and killed by David. Are we whitewashing him completely and saying nothing wrong at all? Of course there was something. God is going to send the Navi in the next chapter. There we're going to have to see how does God look at it. What happened here that was bad? What term, you know, is he going to be accused of having committed a crime of living with an Eshet Ish? Is that what God is going to accuse him of? Or not? All right, that's enough for today. The point really being made, Tanakh, Lahavdil, like any other discipline, can only be understood within its natural habitat, its own context, and the language of Tanakh is very, very special. Okay.